The paper's called True for Me, but Not for You, Moral Relativism and Moral Truth. This is just the outline, so if you're feeling lost, you should be somewhere in one of these sections. But it should be very easy to follow. And if it isn't, that's my fault. So, first, just a very brief introduction. This talk is about relativism, with a special focus on moral relativism. First, I'm going to explain what relativism is. Second, I'm going to make some remarks concerning what people are relativists about. Third, I'll say a fair number of things about moral relativism. Fourth, I'll say some things about a kind of relativism that isn't moral relativism, but instead a different kind. And the reason I'm including this material is not just that it's interesting, but also because I think that at least in our culture, this other kind of relativism is often driven by what you might call a moral concern. So it's also related. In fifth, I'm going to just make a little bit of remarks about the concept of interfering with other people's decisions or something like that. That's something that keeps coming up, so I'll have to say something about it at the end. And then I'll just say that I'm done. All right. So, introductory remarks about relativism. Relativism, roughly speaking, is the idea that there isn't an absolute truth that's the same for everyone, but instead, something is true for one person, but not necessarily for another. So, for example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that sex should be reserved for marriage, but it's not true for me. Or, for another example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that there is no God, but for me, there is a God. Now, right away, we have to be careful not to get tripped up by language. Can you hear me in the back, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Right away, we have to be careful not to get tripped up by language. Sometimes, in contemporary English, words and expressions like the imaginary ones that I just quoted are just a way of expressing the fact that people disagree about something. So, for example, someone might say this, open quotes, for the Greek philosopher Plato, humans have a soul that survives death. But for the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, there is no soul. And all that they would mean, really, is this. Plato believes that humans have a soul that survives death, and Hobbes doesn't. He doesn't believe they have a soul at all. That's all that they would mean. So somebody who said those things would not actually be asserting that one thing was really true for Hobbes and another thing was really true for Plato. In fact, they could say that whole little speech that I made up there while thinking to themselves, Plato's right and Hobbes is wrong, or the opposite. They could say that little speech and think Hobbes is right and Plato's wrong. So what I'm trying to say is right at the outset, we have to make sure that we're clear in our minds when we're really talking about relativism and when we're just using language that sounds like relativism, but it's just a roundabout way of saying that people disagree, which actually isn't super interesting, right? Now, here is something interesting, though. In a funny way, relativism rejects the idea that people disagree. If I say it's true for me that God exists, and you say it's true for you that God doesn't exist, we aren't disagreeing. It's similar to when I say that my favorite ice cream flavor is coffee, and you say that yours is chocolate. That's not a disagreement. We're just expressing our preferences. So if relativism is true, then when people say things like, God exists for me but not for you, they aren't really discussing disagreement. They're just sort of discussing the idea that people live in parallel realities. Now, to tell you the truth, I suspect that there's some way in which the very notion of relativism doesn't actually make sense. And by that, I don't mean just that it's false, but something actually even worse. I suspect that it's sort of incoherent or meaningless. But I'm not sure. That's like a big, complicated philosophical debate. I don't want to get into that in this talk. So what I want to do instead is just to assume that relativism makes sense, and then to discuss why people think that relativism is so important, and also why we can do just fine without relativism. relativism. Okay, so next section, what people are relativist about. A super strong version of relativism says that every truth is relative. It's true for me that eating meat is okay, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that the Bible is inspired, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that 2 + 2 = 4, but it might not be true for you. Okay? So all truths are relative. That's the super strong version. And I'm going to call this total relativism. Now, total relativism, I am not sure any philosopher has ever held total relativism. It seems like a kind of hopeless theory because it undermines itself. If total relativism is true, then everything that's true is true only in a relative way. But that includes total relativism. So if total relativism is only relatively true, then it might not be true for me, you see. So total relativism as a theory has got a lot of problems. So let's just kind of leave it behind. What's really interesting and what I think is really going on usually when people talk about relativism are the various types of what we might call partial relativism. A partial relativist theory says that some truths are relative, but not all. So, for example, someone might say that political opinions are relative, but mathematics and physics aren't. That's the kind of thing that people could say. Now, the first point I want to make is that partial relativism is not self-undermining the way total relativism was. If you say that only some truths are relative while others are absolute, then you can say that partial relativism itself is one of the absolute truths. That's perfectly coherent. So partial relativism doesn't have to apply to partial relativism itself. And that's okay because partial relativism never said that all truths are relative, just some. The second thing to say is that although partial relativism isn't self-undermining, that doesn't automatically mean that it's true. Like, that's a pretty low bar for any theory to pass, right? That it doesn't undermine itself. There's a lot of bad theories that aren't self-undermining. But of course, if it is false, we would have to come up with why. Okay. The third thing to say is that there are many different kinds of partial relativism. For any partial realm of beliefs that you can think of, there could be a partial relativism applied to that realm. So someone could say that not all truths are relative, but moral truth is always relative. Or someone could say that not all truths are relative, but truths about art and literature are always relative. Some people could say that not all truths are relative, but truths about religion are relative, and so on. I mean, I could go on for an hour like this. So there's a lot of different versions of partial relativism. Now, partial relativism that focuses on morality or ethics is or seems to be extremely common in our society. So this kind of relativism is usually called ethical relativism or moral relativism. Many people believe in moral relativism, or anyway, they think they do. You'll see what I mean. Because it's so common, and because, in my opinion, it exhibits something that's very important for relativism overall, I want to turn now to focus on moral relativism for a while. So this is like the biggest section of the paper. Got to get ready. Okay, moral relativism. Moral relativism says that although not all truths are relative, moral truths are. Claims about what is right or wrong, according to this approach, are never absolutely true. They're only true for this person or for that person. It may be true for you that lying is always wrong, but that doesn't mean it's true for me. Now, why would someone believe in moral relativism? One reason you sometimes hear is this. People don't agree about morality, so morality is relative. Or here's another version of the same kind of thought. It's actually a different idea, but it's similar. You can't convince other people about right and wrong, so therefore morality is relative. Now, it seems to me that these are not really very good reasons for believing in moral relativism. Just because people can't agree on some truth, all by itself, that doesn't mean that the truth isn't objective. It might be out there in all its absoluteness and glory without everyone being able to agree on it. Maybe it's out there, but it's really hard to see. Maybe it's out there, but we're just too blind or stupid or whatever. Maybe it can be proved, but the proofs are too complicated for most people to follow. Or maybe it can't be proved by anybody, but it's still just true. So what I'm saying is the mere fact of disagreement, or the fact that it's difficult to convince people or to prove things, does not by itself prove that there's no truth to be proved. It doesn't prove that there's nothing to disagree about or to demonstrate. So I've said a little bit about one reason why relativism seems to make sense to people. There's a lot more to be said about moral relativism. If I wanted to give a full account, there would be a lot of background questions we'd have to address. For example, what is morality in the first place? And then we would have to make a list as long as we could of all the reasons why people believe that moral claims are relative. And then we would have to go through all of those arguments and see whether they're good or not and find responses to all of them. And then, just to make sure that we were on the right track, we would have to come up with a non-relative theory of morality, ideally, to put against all the relative claims. Okay, so discuss all of that would take all night. And in fact, it would take a number of one semester courses. So this is an enormous project, and I don't want to pretend that we can pull off anything like that. So I'm certainly not going to try anything like that tonight. But as a matter of fact, I think it's okay to just sidestep all of that for our purposes here. And that's because, as far as I can tell, almost no one actually believes in moral relativism. They may say they do, but they don't really. They don't, for example, think that it's just relative whether torturing small children is wrong. Now, maybe like in a philosophy class, you could get someone to say that, right? But generally speaking, you know, people don't believe these claims, right? So if I said to these people, well, you know, if I said to most people, well, you know, torturing small children is okay for me, they would say, well, it's not true for you. It's just not true for you. And if you think it is, you're really wrong. Now, as I say, there may be a few people out there who really believe in moral relativism, but let me point something out. They're probably all professional philosophers. So that tells you something. I think that most people who seem to be relativists are actually something else. They are people who believe in moral non-relativism, but they use the language of moral relativism as a weapon for warding off certain evils. So I want to try to make this clear by giving an example. Let's suppose you see three people in the street, Rocky, Nick, and Ella. Now, Rocky is stoning Nick to death because Nick committed fornication. And Ella thinks it's wrong for Rocky to stone Nick for committing fornication. So Ella says, hey, stop, Rocky. You shouldn't force your values on Nick. Don't you know that what's wrong for you might be right for him? Morality is relative, so you have no right to act that way. Now, if you're having trouble keeping track of the names, Rocky is the guy who's stoning someone. Nick is the guy who committed fornication. And Ella is the relativist. Okay? So it took me a little while, but now it's easy. Now you know. It's easy to remember. Okay. I don't think it would be too surprising if we heard Ella say these things. But notice something weird here. Ella is telling Rocky that it's wrong to stone Nick to death for committing fornication. Ella is obviously not a moral relativist. Then, however, Ella goes on to affirm moral relativism in her attempt to get Rocky to not do something wrong. So Ella is using moral relativism in order to support a non-relative moral claim. She's using moral relativism in support of moral absolutism. Now, I said that this is weird. It's actually worse than weird. It's incoherent. It's self-undermining. Above, I said that moral relativism whatever its flaws might be, isn't self-undermining, and I'm not backing away from that here. I am saying, however, that it is self-undermining to use moral relativism in defense of moral absolutism. So if your appeal to moral relativism is true, then you shouldn't be able to use it to support a moral claim. And in fact, if Ella makes that mistake, then Rocky can just, you know, pause in between rocks and say to her, well, huh, so is morality really relative? Well then, it's right for me to bash Nick's head in. Okay, so why then would Ella act in this incoherent and self-undermining way? Well, for one thing, it's probably the case that Ella hasn't had a chance to attend enough talks sponsored by the Thomistic Institute. But I do think there's something else going on here that deserves reflection. Ella is trying to prevent Rocky from wrongly interfering in Nick's life. Ella thinks either that Rocky shouldn't interfere with Nick's choices at all, or that he's getting involved in the wrong way. For example, maybe Ella thinks it would be okay for Rocky to take Nick out for coffee and have a little chat about sexual morality, but that bashing his head in is taking it too far, right? So she either thinks that he shouldn't intervene at all, or that he should intervene in a different way. So it seems to me like that's her motivation. So we can distinguish her tool from her goal. Her goal is to protect Nick from a certain kind of illegitimate interference or harm. That's her goal. Her tool is the affirmation of moral relativism. Now, I've tried to explain that, as I've said, Ella's choice of tools undermines her goal. But we can ask whether a different tool might enable Ella to reach the same goal, namely the goal of protecting Nick from illegitimate interference. So what I want to do now is discuss two different tools that Ella could make use of. The first is the distinction between making an ethical claim, on the one hand, and forcing people to go along with an ethical claim. You can think that something is morally wrong without thinking that it's legitimate to force others to conform. For example, I might think fornication is morally wrong without thinking that I have a right to force people not to do it. Likewise, you can think that something is morally obligatory without thinking that it's right to force others to go along with it. So maybe I think that helping one's parents when they get old is morally obligatory, but that doesn't automatically mean that I think that there should be laws forcing people to help their parents. That's a different question. Now, this distinction might seem obvious, and probably in the abstract, it is obvious. But in practice, especially when they're arguing, like on Facebook or something, in practice, people get confused. If you merely make a moral claim, people will sometimes say something like, "How dare you try to force your values on me?" So for example, suppose someone says, "I think it's wrong to commit fornication." The person who says this might not be trying to force anything on anyone, but we all know it wouldn't be surprising if someone reacted by saying, "How dare you to force me to act in accordance with your values?" So this isn't really a logical way for people to react, because the person hasn't said any such thing, but it happens all the time. And avoiding it requires a kind of mental discipline. You have to listen to what the other person actually said. It's hard to do. A special version of this distinction between making a claim and enforcing a claim is the distinction between ethics and politics. You can think that something is morally wrong without thinking that it should be illegal. You can, for example, think that fornication is wrong or marijuana smoking is wrong or whatever without thinking that they should be criminalized. Likewise, you can, yeah, okay, so you see the point here? So there's a special version for the law too, right? You could think that something should be obligatory, like being nice to people, without thinking that it should be a law that you have to be nice to people. Okay, so ethics and politics are different. Now, again, this special version might seem obvious, but in practice, people forget about this distinction all the time. Suppose you say, I mean, just try this. Suppose you say that a good corporate executive will guarantee that the highest paid person in the company doesn't make more than so and so many times as much money as the lowest paid person. It could be 10 times more, 50 times more, it doesn't matter. If you say this sort of thing, it's pretty well guaranteed that someone will say, wait, are you saying the government should make a law and then audit every company to ensure that this happens? But of course, you didn't say that. You said nothing about laws or politics at all. You said that this would be morally praiseworthy. Perhaps you even said that it was a moral obligation, but you didn't say that the government should get involved and force people to do it. But it's really common for people to interpret statements in that way. You say something ethical, they hear something political. They aren't keeping in mind the distinction between ethics and politics. So, yeah, it might sound obvious, but I guess it's not. And anyway, it needs repeating and it requires mental discipline. Okay, perhaps you can guess already the way in which I think this stuff that I've been saying is relevant to our topic. I'll explain it in terms of both versions of the distinction. To begin with, making an ethical claim doesn't automatically require thinking that it's good to force people to conform to the claim. Rocky can believe that Nick's behavior is wrong without believing he would be justified in forcing Nick to conform to this. So since that's true, Ella does not need to appeal to moral relativism. She can instead appeal to the principle that knowing that something is wrong, that knowing that someone's acting wrongly doesn't automatically give you a right to force them to act in a certain way. And this is a more logical strategy for Ella because it isn't self-undermining. Now let's switch over and look at the ethics and politics version of this distinction. Politics inevitably involves the use of force to intervene in what people are doing. It inevitably involves the potential use of force, either to make them stop doing something or to make them start doing something. Now, I don't mean that politics is nothing but force, but it's a special fact about politics that the application of force is essential to it. Ethics, however, is not like that. I can hold ethical views and make ethical claims without attempting to use the force of law. Now, in the example that I gave above with Ella and Rocky and Nick, it's not actually an example of politics. Rocky isn't a member of the police enforcing the law, but we can just change the example to make it fit this part of the discussion. Suppose Rocky wants to make fornication illegal so that Nick will be thrown in jail. Ella might appeal to moral relativism to block this, but she has a more logical strategy, namely appealing to the distinction between ethics and politics. So she just doesn't need moral relativism. In fact, she can firmly embrace moral absolutism, even including moral absolutism about premarital sex. But then she can just say that although fornication is wrong, it's not the sort of thing that should be criminalized. See, this is an option that's open to her. So she has an alternative tool for getting Rocky to not interfere wrongly with Nick's life. So, that's the first tool that Ella could have used. And the tool had two versions, a non-political version and a political version. But the basic idea that they have in common can be summed up as follows. There's a difference between making a moral claim and forcing someone to go along with the claim. And once you see this difference, then you don't need relativism anymore. Okay, now let's turn to the second tool that Ella could use. And this one is nicely captured in the slogan that you sometimes hear, love the sinner and hate the sin. It's amazing how few people really understand this and remember it. People often think, quite rightly, that we should have a loving attitude towards everyone. And they notice that people who criticize others' moral behavior often do this in a harsh and unloving way. So, in order to get people to act in a loving way, they decide that it's bad to form negative judgments about other people's behavior. If there's no such thing as sin, you can't hate sinners because there are no sinners to hate. In other words, they see moral relativism as a pathway to love. This might be behind Ella's rebuke of Rocky. She wants Rocky to love Nick, not hate him. And she sees that Rocky's mistreatment of Nick is rooted in the fact that Rocky doesn't like Nick's sins. So she tries to convince Rocky that there's no such thing as sin, because moral truth is relative. This will, she hopes, reorient Rocky's way of thinking so that he can love Nick. Now, it's a strange but powerful fact that in this case, Ella has actually accepted the fact, sorry, not the fact, Ella has actually accepted the idea that we should hate sinners. Rocky thinks we should hate sinners, and he believes in sin, so therefore he thinks we should hate Nick. Ella agrees with Rocky that we should hate sinners, if there are any, but she doesn't want anyone to hate Nick, or anyone, so she just decides that there must not be any sinners. But maybe Ella and Rocky are both wrong here. Maybe, this is really going to be a weird thought now, maybe we shouldn't hate sinners. Maybe we should love sinners, but hate their sins. So if Ella could learn to think like this, then she wouldn't have to appeal to moral relativism to defend Nick from Rocky. She could point out that although Nick's behavior needs improvement, we should still try to love him and help him. Resorting to relativism isn't needed to make this appeal. Okay, I've just suggested two ways of thinking that would allow Ella to protect Nick without resorting to moral relativism. Before leaving this topic, I'd like to bring up a possible objection to what I've been saying. Perhaps these alternate tools cannot be used in place of relativism as a way of protecting Nick from illegitimate interference. Because perhaps even making and expressing a moral judgment is already a form of illegitimate interference. In other words, maybe the mere act of telling someone that their actions are wrong is all by itself already an unacceptable interference in that person's life. If that were true, then these other tools that I mentioned would not be enough, because they still allow Rocky to express his views. Now, my first response to this is to say that even if merely voicing moral disagreement was already illegitimate interference, even then, moral relativism is not needed to block it. Instead, we could just have a rule that people should keep their moral judgments to themselves. In other words, we could say that morality is absolute and it's okay for Rocky to disagree with Nick's behavior so long as he doesn't voice this opinion. So if merely voicing disagreement counts as unfair meddling in others' lives, the solution needn't be relativism. It could just be silence. My second response is to wonder about the mental toughness of people who can't handle it when others disagree with them. Now, I do understand that some people have thin skin, and I don't think it's nice to be mean to people with thin skin. But even so, having really thin skin is a fault, not a virtue. I should be able to deal with it when you disagree with me. For example, I think it's okay to eat meat. Maybe you don't. If you think that eating meat is wrong, you should be able to tell me that. Obviously, you have to choose the right time and place. Obviously, you should do it in a polite fashion. You should consider the possibility that it would be wiser to not say anything at all and let me figure it out on my own. Maybe you can tell that I'm so amazingly sensitive that I might have a nervous breakdown if you raise the issue, so you're just going to, on balance, it's better to just let it go. Right, there are always these practical things to take into consideration, and being, you know, a decent and polite person involves thinking about those things. But it remains the case that, in principle, you have the right to voice your disagreement with me. It might make me feel uncomfortable. It might make me feel a little bit pressured. But part of being a grown-up is dealing with the fact that people don't always agree with you. So if I can't get through life without requiring everyone to be really nice to me all the time, then maybe I'm the one with the problem. Maybe instead of resorting to moral relativism, I should spend a lot more time camping or join the army or something to toughen me up. Now, above I said that Ella's appeal to moral relativism was incoherent insofar as she was using it in order to make an absolute point about morality. But now I want to discuss a more subtle version of Ella's approach, one that might not suffer from this flaw. Maybe she isn't a total moral relativist. Maybe she's just a relativist about some moral issues. So instead of being a partial relativist, but relative about all moral issues, she's actually got a smaller realm. It's only some moral issues that she's a relativist about. In particular, maybe her idea is this. Morality, she might be thinking, is absolute whenever your actions affect other people. But when your actions affect only yourself, then morality is relative. In other words, this theory holds that interpersonal morality is absolute, but personal morality is relative. So, for example, the obligation not to kill innocent people is absolute, but personal morality is relative. This theory, I skipped a line. This theory holds that interpersonal morality is absolute, but personal morality is relative. So, for example, the obligation not to kill innocent people isn't one of those things that's true for some people but not true for others, because it concerns others. But, for example, the obligation to not get outrageously drunk or not use pornography is one of those things that's true for some people but not true for others, because it concerns only yourself. If my actions concern only me, then whether they are right or wrong is just true for me. This is something that somebody could propose. Now, this theory is not self-defeating in the way that Ella's first approach was. However, there are three considerations that tend to make it seem less than perfectly impressive. First, are there any good reasons for thinking that personal morality is relative while interpersonal morality is absolute? Why think that? It's just not clear why anybody should believe this. If it's wrong to harm others, why isn't it also wrong to harm myself? Aren't I a person too? So repeated binge drinking will definitely hurt me, and that's wrong. And the fact that the person is me just doesn't seem to have anything to do with that. Second, the distinction between personal and interpersonal morality isn't as clear as people sometimes wish to believe. If I harm myself, that will have spillover effects that affect other people as well. The idea that I can become lazy, hedonistic, and so on without this harming other people, it's kind of naive. Third, I'm pretty sure that the real motive behind saying that personal morality is relative is the thought that actions that affect only me, if there are any really, that actions like that are actions that other people shouldn't interfere with. Well, if that's the point, if interference is the issue, then we should just go back to all the points we were making before about interfering. In order to argue that interference is bad with regard to a certain realm of action, it's not necessary to say that moral relativism holds for that realm. You could just as easily stick to moral absolutism, but then add, first, that making a moral judgment doesn't mean forcing the other person to abide by it, and second, that you can hate the sin without hating the sinner. So overall, even though there's no incoherence in this second version of Ella's position, the version that distinguishes personal from interpersonal morality, it's still not a very convincing position. Just looking at my watch here. We started a little late, right? Is that okay? Are people like dying to run away yet? Should I keep going? Okay. I mean, I feel you. Okay. Now I'm switching topics now. New topic. Relativism outside of morality. I've spent a lot of time talking about moral relativism. I've claimed that almost no one believes in it. And I've tried to show how the apparent advantages to be gained by believing in it can be gotten in other ways. Now I'd like to switch over to talking about relativism that holds outside the realm of morality. I think this form of relativism is also very common in our culture, and I want to say a few things about what seems to be behind it. First, let me make clear what sort of relativism I'm talking about. It's not, of course, relativism about moral claims, about the way things should be, but relativism about the way things are. So, for example, If I say that gold has a higher density than carbon, that's a claim about the way things are, not about the way things should be. Now, someone who is a relativist about chemistry would say that although gold is denser than carbon for me, it might not be denser than carbon for you. Now, that, you're laughing. Okay, yeah. So that might be a kind of a fairly crazy claim. Maybe that's a claim that no one would want to make. Claims about physical facts like that are usually not considered relative. But it's interestingly, it's quite widely held that not all claims about reality are like this. For example, if I said, I accept that God exists for you, but not for me, I think many people would nod understandingly, maybe even approvingly, even though if I'd said that about the density of gold and carbon, they would have laughed the way you did. Why is this? Isn't it just a fact whether God exists or not, one way or the other? Isn't it a fact one way or a fact the other way? Isn't it the case that if God doesn't exist, then atheism is just true? Deal with it. And if God does exist, then theism is true? Deal with it. Of course, maybe we can't tell whether God exists or not. That's a different question. There doesn't seem to be any room for the idea that for some people God does exist and for other people God doesn't exist. And yet, as I've already noted, people are very comfortable with saying that religious truths are relative. Now, I suspect that there are other cases, too, of people endorsing a relativistic understanding outside the realm of morality. But we don't need to go into that right now. So let's just focus on the example of religion. Why would people give a relativistic account of religion? One reason is very similar to the reason why some people go for moral relativism. It seems that if religious claims are put forward in a non-relativist manner, this will inevitably lead to strife and oppression. On this view, people who are serious about religion beat on other people pretty hard. So we should encourage everyone to be relativist about religion. Now, one problem with this is it's far from clear that religious people are particularly prone to harm others. Joseph Stalin and Chairman Mao, they were not exactly paragons of tolerance and benevolence, but they were not religious either. So this issue is far more complicated than the advocates of religious relativism would have it. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of really scarily intolerant religious people. I'm not trying to deny that. But it's not clear that they've got a corner on the intolerance market. Another problem, a more important problem, is that there's just no need to posit religious relativism in order to deter religious people from oppressing others. All you have to say is, well, I mean, this is the argument that you would want to make. That's my point. All you have to say is that just because such and such is a religious truth, it doesn't follow that it makes sense to oppress people over it. You could say, look, I know those people are heretics. What does that have to do with putting them in jail? You don't put heretics in jail. You argue with heretics. So, in short, it's possible to believe strongly in religion in a non-relativistic way while also believing in religious freedom. However, I don't think that the worry about religious intolerance and oppression is the only thing going on in relativism about religion. And I don't even think it's the most important thing going on. The really crucial thing, here's my idea now, is a certain attitude towards life that I think is now quite common in our society. I'm going to call it feelings management. The idea of feelings management is that the task of living consists in managing your feelings so that on balance, they're as positive as they can be. Now, I've chosen the word feelings on purpose to straddle both emotions and physical sensations. Feelings management is concerned with both, and figuring out how they are related is a crucial task for feelings management. For example, running a marathon is pretty unpleasant, but having run a marathon gives you a sense of accomplishment and bragging rights and so on. For some people, the negative sensations of pain and fatigue in running the race just don't outweigh the positive emotions after the race, while for others, they do. And of course, you don't just have to balance physical sensations against emotions. You also have to balance physical sensations against other physical sensations and emotions against other emotions. It's very complicated. But anyway, feelings management is about somehow juggling your physical sensations and your emotions in such a way that overall, you end up feeling as good as possible. And I think that for a lot of people, trying to live a good life means being a good feelings manager. I think we should all ask ourselves, how often am I actually doing this? Like, it's, you know, I can describe it in a way that makes it seem comical, but like, this is something that everyone is drawn towards because it feels good, you see. So you could try, so for a lot of people, maybe even us, trying to live a good life means being a good feelings manager. You try to avoid feeling physical pain, but perhaps a little physical pain is a price worth paying for being healthier. You enjoy your successes, but you try to avoid gloating about them because when others feel bad in comparison, it makes you feel guilty. You try to avoid feeling guilty, but maybe a little bit of guilt helps spur you on to accomplish something satisfying. But the ultimate test all the way through is, how does it make me feel? Now notice, when I gave the example of running a marathon, I noted that running a marathon seems to be a good choice for some feelings managers, but a bad choice for others. What works for you might not work for me. This really does seem to be a place where relativity reigns. Well, I think that's why people end up thinking that religion is a relative matter. Some people use God and religion in general as part of their toolkit for feelings management. Believing in God, praying, and engaging in certain religious rituals gives certain people a sense of mission, a sense of consolation, inner peace, and so forth. Other people, by contrast, find religion really stressful. God seems threatening and judging and all of that. For these people, God and religion are not helpful parts of a toolkit for feelings management. So when people say, God exists for me, maybe what they mean is that believing in God is helpful as part of their personal strategy for feelings management. And when other people say, God doesn't exist for me, maybe what they mean is that believing in God is not helpful to them as part of their strategy for feelings management. Maybe they even mean that disbelieving in God is helpful for them. And what applies to God might apply to other things too, such as believing that there's some kind of constants in human nature or something like that. Some people find it helpful, so they say it's true for them. Others don't, so they say it's not true for them. If it's right, then it's interesting to note that somehow, for people like this, you don't believe things because you think they're true. You believe things because doing so helps you feel better. No wonder that truth becomes relative, because different things give different people different feelings. So with all these ideas in hand, we can now make a connection with our earlier topic of moral relativism. Moral relativism can be part of feelings management. If a certain moral ideal is too challenging, if I keep failing and feeling guilty, or if adhering to this ideal means I have to miss out on pleasures that I'm unwilling to give up, then I can just say that the moral ideal isn't true for me. Moral relativism is great for minimizing or even eliminating guilt. If, on the other hand, I like behaving in a certain way, then maybe I will decide that this way of acting is right for me. Once I've decided that, I will feel even better about doing these kinds of actions. I'm doing what's right. And I will be more likely to persist in doing it. But notice, if the bottom line concern is how I feel, then there won't be any sense in thinking about morality as something objective or absolute, but only about how it works for me. There are certain deep philosophical issues that are hard to argue about. Usually the way you try to settle disputes, generally speaking, is by appealing to a deeper principle. So you can sometimes settle a dispute in engineering by appealing to some principle in physics or chemistry. But in philosophy, pretty much by definition, you're trying to get as close to the foundations as you can. I mean, if you weren't doing that, you wouldn't be doing philosophy. at a certain point, you can't appeal to principles any deeper than the ones that you're considering because you've already hit rock bottom. This doesn't mean that there's no truth about the matter, and it doesn't even mean that it can't be discovered, but it does mean that making progress is very difficult. I think that when we're discussing these sorts of issues, like feelings management, we're close to being at that kind of point. I do not think that living a good life is a matter of feelings management. I think it's just about fully living out the kinds of being that we are, a rational animal of a certain sort. Just as there's a way for chickens to flourish or fail to flourish, so too is there a way for humans to flourish or fail to flourish. Morality, in my view, and this is a Thomistic thing to say, is a matter of flourishing, and wrong actions are those in which we fail to actualize ourselves in the right way, those in which we fail to flourish, whether through harming others or through harming ourselves, or usually both. Anyway, if that's right, or even close to right, then feelings management is just the wrong approach to life. The goal of life isn't just to feel good, because we all know it's possible to feel pretty good while doing things that aren't good examples of being human, and also that it's possible to train ourselves to feel good about bad things. But when you're down at first principles in philosophy, it's hard to argue why that's a better position. And I want to acknowledge that. Okay, well, this is going on a little bit long. The next section I was going to do is about interference. I'll just read it. It's really short. Okay, listen. There's an issue that I have raised, but I've not resolved it or even addressed it. It's the question of the extent to which it's legitimate or even obligatory to interfere in others' moral decisions. Because, in my view, people resort to moral relativism as a way of opposing illegitimate interference, I've built my argument around the idea that you don't need relativism for that. But I don't want to give the impression that I think that it's always wrong to interfere with others' decisions. First, I think it's fairly clear that at least sometimes it's acceptable and even obligatory to tell someone that they're going astray. I know that my life has been improved by other people calling me out on things, and I hope that I would have the guts and the charity to do the same thing for others. Second, there really are times when we have to not just tell people that what they're doing is wrong, we have to block their actions. Sometimes we have to intervene. In the silly example I gave earlier, or maybe not so silly, Ella should not just argue with Rocky, like doing philosophy there. She should grab his arms and try to make him stop throwing stones at Nick. Third, there really are some times when immoral behavior needs to be criminalized. Stealing cars or shooting people, it should be against the law, I think. So, of course, this paper hasn't begun. It hasn't even begun to make clear when interference is good, what kind of interference is good, blah, blah, blah. But I just want to point out that I wasn't trying to say that it's never warranted. I wasn't trying to say that. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Huge, huge question. Okay, conclusion. Relativism about the nature of reality and about morals can ultimately be overcome only through a positive view of what ethics is about and also through getting the contents of that ethics right, which of course is way beyond this talk. You have to see that life isn't about feelings management, and you have to see that the ethical principles involve not only judgments about what's right and wrong, but also about when it is and isn't legitimate to interfere with others' decisions. If we could get all that straight, then we would no longer be tempted by relativism. We'd be drawn instead to the truth. Thank you.
Thank you again for the lecture. Now we'll open up the floor for questions. So raise your hand if you have any objections. I'll just go around the room. Well, everybody agrees.
I guess I'm wondering, two points. One, where you get this morality from. You're arguing that, there needs to be, that it's not relative, but, what's the source of morality? Also, you argue that people don't necessarily want, that the people don't believe things be true for us, but not true for them. But I'm wondering, what you said, it's interesting because some people that believe that it's true. What about people that do believe that it's true, that do genuinely believe, like no, I don't believe in doing F. Like no, I genuinely don't believe in God. That's like a legitimate argument. And they're not saying God might be true for you, but it's not, it is true for me. But like, they're literally saying like, I don't believe in God because they genuinely don't. And also like my third question would be, what about a situation where somebody would like, where two of these like ethics or morals are contradicting one another? Like in the situation you gave, Ella's getting angry at Rocky for throwing rocks because Rocky thinks what Nick did is wrong. You argued that Ella also probably believes that what Nick did is wrong. But like in this case, if she did, how do you choose which standard to go for?
Okay. Let me start with the middle question, if I understand it correctly. Were you saying that some people aren't saying things like, maybe God exists for you but not for me? They're just saying, boom, I'm an atheist. Nope, God doesn't exist for anybody.
I mean, I think like that it's not just that. It's like, it's in terms of a lot of things. Like you might believe that, but I don't. That's just like the way that society works.
Yeah.
And that's not saying that it's true for you. By me saying, oh, right, you believe in God, I don't. That's not saying like, oh, for you, God is true. That's just me saying like, that's what you believe, but I don't believe that. And my belief, my truth is not your perception. Makes sense?
Well, I'm not sure I follow you yet. Look, if you say there is no God, atheism is true, that's not relativism. You might be right, you might be wrong, but it's not relativism. I mean, not about God. You're saying this is just the way it is. Maybe it's good news, maybe it's bad news, but anyway, this is the way it is. That's not a relativist claim. And you would be aware that other people disagree with you, and you would think that their views are incorrect.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not relativism. So I wasn't talking about that kind of thing. That's like disagreement. But disagreement is fine. That's what you get when you have, once you drop relativism, then you suddenly discover people really disagree. Well, I do sort of think that almost no one is a relativist. But a lot of people, well, let me think. Okay, about morality, I think pretty nearly no one is a relativist. Because they will acknowledge, they'll say they're relativists, but it's not usually that hard to find things where they'll go, oh yeah, you're right. Okay, that would be terrible. We should never allow that to happen. That would be wrong. So they aren't really moral relativists. I mean, I have met people who claim to be moral relativists. But as I say, like, they were philosophers. So now, it's more common for people to stick to their guns about relativism, about religion. That was one of the reasons I thought it was worth talking about. But I think that's because they're driven by this thing that I called feelings management. But I think it would be better to work your way towards a point where you said, look, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to try to invent theories about the way the universe is to make myself feel better. Like, I should try to find out whether there's God. And if there is, I better deal with that. And if there isn't, then I better deal with that. But I shouldn't just sort of create the theory in a way that makes me feel better. So, now, you asked two other things. The last one was, what about what happens when ethical views are opposed? I mean, that happens a lot, right? Sometimes people's ethical views are opposed in ways that doesn't give rise to all that much conflict. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's wrong to, you know, eat chickens that lived in cages, and you don't. But, like, I go to my store, you go to your store, it's not that much conflict. Other times, though, lots of conflict can arise. Occasionally, people beat each other's faces in and kill each other. I mean, that happens.
I'm saying internal. I'm saying internal.
Oh!
Within.
Meaning, go on, spell that out.
Meaning you have one moral conflict that conflicts with another.
Oh!
I want to do X. Not necessarily, yeah. I want to do X, but, right, like, in the situation you gave, if Ella believes that fornication is illegal, then she obviously believes that, but that would go not necessarily against, but that might specifically go against her telling Rocky not to throw rocks.
Yeah.
Like,
good.
That's internal.
Right. Okay, let me think. I think probably there's two kinds of internal conflicts. One is when you have two moral beliefs that really are inconsistent with one another. So I actually believe that everybody should get to do whatever they want. And I also believe that I should stop people from doing this, that, or the other thing. So those can't both be true because they contradict one another. Now, usually when you... people don't usually have openly contradictory beliefs like that. Once you realize, holy cow, I believe these two things, you're like, whoa, I can't believe both of those. Now I'm confused. I don't know what's going on. But I do think that sometimes people sort of hold contradictory beliefs without quite realizing it. I mean, we're all subject to this, probably. So there's one set of considerations I have, and I tend to think like this, and then there's another set that I think in this other way, and I've never noticed that they don't actually come together in a coherent way. So if I notice that, then it creates a little mini crisis for me, and I have to try to figure out what I think is really right. But there's no magic formula for doing that. The other kind of conflict I think that can happen is more on the level of feelings or inclinations, where I think that something is right, but on the other hand, I want to act in a different way. And that's not always going to be because I'm selfish, right? Maybe I think private property is a really good thing, and I also think you have a really awesome car, so I just feel this urge to steal your car. And that's just me, you know, being selfish. But there could be other things where your moral beliefs make you do something that... I don't know. Okay, so here, I'll give an example that comes from the real life of, like, being a teacher. You may think, like, and this is a situation where the best thing I can do for this student is to fail him. But I might feel bad about doing that, you know? So that's a different kind of conflict. That's kind of a conflict between my feelings and what I think I should do. That requires kind of moral strength. You have to learn how to just deal with those conflicts and do what you think is right, even if it makes you feel lousy sometimes. Now, your first question had to do with where does morality come from? Like, where do you know what's the right view of morality? That's an enormous question, of course, and it's a hugely important question. There's lots of different... we all start where we start from, right? There's no other place to start from. So everybody has some moral beliefs, and they got them from somewhere. So that's where you start thinking from. But on a theoretical... looking at it theoretically, there are different theories of what ethics amounts to. Some have to do with distributing pleasures as widely as possible. Others have to do with following absolute rational moral laws. Others have to do what I mentioned a little bit at the end, thinking that each kind of living thing has a special way that it can flourish and grow and be sort of actualize itself. And that's the best way for it to live. And then to think of morality along those lines. So I try to understand what does it mean to really be a human being firing on all cylinders and get as close to that as I can. But that's an enormous question. I don't know. I can't say more than that right now. I mean, you could spend your whole life thinking about that, and it wouldn't be a bad idea either. Let me see.
So we're a little probability represent violence. Strong probability that God doesn't exist, but for you, it's a higher probability that God exists. Does that make sense?
Well, let me think. If that is a way of expressing disagreement, like you and I might set the probabilities differently. So that's just disagreement, and that's not relativism. There's actually a tricky question of what it means to set probabilities to things like that, right? I mean, the natural home of probability...
well, like a high probability.
Yeah. Well, that might be a way of saying that, you know, you have low confidence or a high confidence or something. But then we aren't really talking about the world. We're talking about ourselves. You're saying... I forget whether you're the pro-God guy or the anti-God guy.
Probably that God does not.
Does not. Okay. So we'll do it that way. So then you're thinking, well, it's possible, but as far as from your perspective, the evidence is points against, and maybe from my perspective, the evidence points in favor. But that's not relativism, because that's consistent with saying, but you know, in the end, there is a God or there isn't, right? So that's an absolute truth, and then it's just then we just assess the probabilities differently. And then we can like be all huffy about it, or we can be nice to one another and talk about it. Maybe we'll, one of us will convince the other or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, is it me?
Well, I was aiming at her, but...
You mentioned earlier about having a thicker skin and kind of in a society where we kind of need to build that up. But do you have any thoughts on slash where do you think the line is between we need to have a thicker skin or the comment that's being made it actually needs intervention?
Wait, what? The very last bit I didn't get.
It's okay, so where's the line between, oh, do you just need to have a thicker skin or the comment I'm making needs intervention or is... Like, I'm the person, so there's two people, like, who are opposing. One person making a comment that is deemed hateful or hurtful by the other person.
Yeah.
Where's the line between, oh, that person needs to have a thicker skin, or this person needs to stop making that comment?
Oh, I see. I don't know. Like, I don't think there's a magic formula for that, and that's a really tough thing. This is a big issue in our society right now, right?
Especially recently.
You know, it's really complicated because it's probably the case, I'm not sure of this, but it's probably the case that a lot of people are simultaneously thin-skinned themselves and expecting the people on the other team to be extra thick-skinned. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in other words, I mean, we all do this from time to time. It's kind of like expecting the other people in your life to always interpret what you say as being reasonable. But of course, if you say something that's kind of slightly dumb, I don't have to like figure out what you really meant. I can just chop you to pieces, right? And like if you're a philosopher, you're good at that, you know. So, I mean, it's a problem, actually. So so it's a little bit like that. So a lot of us will be, you know, I can't believe you're saying that. You're really hurting my feelings. Meanwhile, at the same time, I don't tiptoe around you. I just like shoot my mouth off, and if it bothers you, well, what are you? You know, you're a crybaby. So I think a good first step would be to all examine our consciences and say, why don't I just start by trying to be even, right? To be as gentle to you as I want you to be gentle to me. Now, that doesn't solve all the problem, but I think it's a good first step. It would get everybody on a sort of more honest level. The next thing I think is that it probably helps to remember that disagreement and being mean isn't automatically the same. And so much of the rhetoric in our society now, it's hard to say I disagree with you without also like dumping on you, right? So why can't I just say, you know, this policy that you're proposing, it has these disadvantages and I don't think they would be good. Like, why do I have to call you the worst thing since Hitler? Like, why do I have to just escalate it like that all the time? So if we could sort of recapture calmer and gentler ways of disagreeing, it might help us all to relearn what it's like to disagree without being mean. So because in principle, you know, you can disagree with people without hurting their feelings. Now, will people still feel stressed out and stuff? Sure. You know, if you tell me that I'm doing something wrong, I'm often not going to enjoy hearing that. And that's part of learning to live with other people, too. But anyway, those first two things, I think. But I don't know. It's a real problem. I mean, as you mentioned, it's a cultural problem. I mean, it feels like bigger in the last week and a half or whatever. And I guess it is, but it's not like that came out of nowhere. It's been like this for a long time. It is getting worse. Let me see. Yeah.
So what if when people are relatives, they're just saying that there might be decisions that have equivalent, I guess, true value, or at least moral value.
Uh-huh.
For example, if you make a trivial decision, like am I going to eat this candy or this candy?
Right.
Both are essentially equivalent and true to in that sense. So they could just be saying that there are many acceptable good things to do, and that you just have, you know, choices. And I add one other thing. And I guess feelings management.
Yeah.
Essentially, did they just say, well, for these kinds of things, which they, I guess, are supposed to say most things are this way, that, you know, being like optimizing your utility or something.
Yeah.
About about that, that's the way that you should just do it.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Let me think. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just because in the end with like the confidence that, you know, like humans or you know, rational beings or which we call, us have a similar internal mechanism, and it's just giving that kind of freedom will guide more conducively to making better choices.
Yeah. Okay, good. So on the one hand, I think that's right. There are a lot of decisions where, yeah, are you going to take like the yellow jelly bean or the blue? Do jelly beans come in blue? I don't know. Let's just say they do, right? So the yellow or the, I don't really like jelly beans. So yellow jelly beans or blue jelly beans, right? So which one do you pick? Well, you pick the one that you like better. What the heck, right? Now, one way to analyze that is to say there's actually no moral issue here at all. So in that case, what the heck, pick the one you like, right? There's no moral issue at all. So that is in a, another way of analyzing that is to say, well, maybe there is. Maybe there's a moral superiority, maybe. But no one can tell. It's too hard to figure it out, and you'll go crazy trying to figure it out. So just like pick one and get on with life, right? There's people drowning over there, and you're worrying about which jelly bean. Like, that doesn't make sense. Now, but that's interesting, because I mean, it is an interesting question whether there are actions that are morally indifferent, right? They're not good, they're not bad, they're just kind of like nothing. No, wait, there was something else that you said at the end that I'm not, I'm forgetting.
How to solve these problems
with that? Oh, in terms of feelings management. Yeah, I mean, I don't, maybe I was a little too harsh on feelings management. I'm not sure. You do have to think about your own feelings, if only for the sake of the other people who have to put up with you, right? So, like, if you're in a really bad mood all the time, that makes everybody else unhappy. So, so there's probably, I think that's probably right, that there's a range of decisions that you can make more or less in that way, right? So if you just hate tea and you like coffee, then just drink coffee and enjoy it, too. That's fine. But I think as an overall strategy for trying to live the good life, it's pretty inadequate. But I do think you're probably, that makes sense to me, that there's like a range of decisions where it makes sense to do it that way. And there's no reason to feel too bad about it then.
Mm-hmm. So do you believe that God gave moral laws that are good and worth following? Why do you believe that?
Wait, sorry, like, I think I missed the first word of your question.
So I assume that you believe that God gave moral laws and that
okay.
they're good to follow and that they're absolute. Why do you believe that?
Well, let me start by saying I don't think that morality is something that can only be known through God-giving laws.
Okay.
Yeah, so... if we had no sense of any revelation from God, we could still know things about morality.
Right.
I mean...
But even if he didn't reveal them, they're still God-given. But they didn't just come out of thin air.
Well, I mean, that's complicated. When you call them laws, it inevitably sounds like a lawgiver. I think that's true. But you can think about morality in a philosophical way that doesn't get into, that doesn't think about it in terms of laws.
I guess I'm just asking, what do you believe and why?
Okay. Well, it would take a good while to state what I believe and much longer to state why. I guess as far as ethics goes, I say roughly because there's a lot of decisions that have to be made, but overall, a roughly Aristotelian kind of approach where different kinds of beings, including human beings, have potentialities and can flourish in certain ways. And what's best, all of the things being equal, is for them to flourish and live out as the kinds of beings that they are. And that looks one way for squirrels and another way for chickens and a special way for us because we have reason. and that if you can try to unpack the notion of morality that way. Now, as a Christian, I also believe that there's divine revelation, and it contains some information about how we ought to live. Those ought to line up pretty well, right? So in a way, then, what that would mean is that God is giving us extra information about what it means to be our best selves. In part because it's hard for humans to figure that out. Does that address your question at all?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering whether like you were like going for the Euthyphro problem here. I don't know what where we were going, so I was trying to make sure I was addressing what you were really asking.
We have about time for one more question. Now we've gone over about 20 minutes. Or if you'd like to stay, mm-hmm. answer the rest of it as well.
Thanks. I wonder if I could make a quick argument for at least partial relativism,
mm-hmm.
For the sake of argument. To be quick, why don't we use an analogy? So let's take sports, for instance. Let's say we have to judge an act that appears violent or deceptive. Before we could judge whether the act is right or wrong, we have to know what sport we were playing and the particular goods of the sport.
Yeah.
So an act could be judged differently if it took place in a mixed martial arts octagon or freestyle wrestling or Greco-Roman wrestling or, for that matter, professional wrestling. So the idea is that actually all life is like that. So we have to talk about precisely what sport we're playing and the goods of it. So to use your example of Rocky, Nick, and Ella,
yeah.
our interpretation of the act would radically differ if the rock throwing was taking place, for instance, just outside, or if the rock throwing was taking place in ancient Israel and Rocky was trying to seek the goods that were in the Mosaic Law
yeah.
at the time. So likewise, you know, you talked about non-interference, particularly with regard to religion. It means something different now
yeah.
than it would in ancient Greece, where there was not even a word for religion because you couldn't separate that activity out from other practices. So kind of the argument for relativism is we have to know what sport we're playing before we can judge any act. And
yeah.
all of our acts are one sport or another.
I think in a way, the deepest way to answer that question, at least that occurs to me right now, standing on my feet here, is that although many of the activities that we engage in are, I mean, this is a good analogy, they're sports, they have a kind of structure that comes from humans making certain decisions about what they want to do. There's one, so to speak, big sport that we're all playing that we didn't construct, and it's called being human. And that's not a game that we choose to play, and it's not a game that we construct, but it's just a game that we're born into. And so it's incumbent on us to try to figure out what that calls forth from us. And also, incidentally, when we make up little games, to ask ourselves whether these are really consistent with the big games. Like you can think of games to play that are not really good things for humans to do. So you'd be creating a little game with internal goals and goods that would undermine what you're really trying to do. So I think in a way, that's a good question, and the way to answer it is by saying that the big activity of being human is not constructed by humans. Thank you.